Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1997, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a critic. He was born in 1919 on the Isle of Man and grew up a clever, introverted boy in that remote and insular part of the United Kingdom. After university and wartime service in the Navy, he went into academic life, becoming one of the most influential critics and teachers of his age, and serving as Professor of English at both London and Cambridge universities. Anyone who studied English literature, however briefly, has probably heard of him. But he remains disenchanted by his eminence. Looking the part, while not being quite equal to it, seems to be something I do rather well, he says. He is Sir Frank Kermode. Professor Kermode, I suspect most men and women of achievement feel like that they're not quite all they're cracked up to being. Isn't that all you're saying, really? Or is it something more than that?
Well, no, I think I would certainly agree that that puts the case for me. I wouldn't like to judge it for other people. I dare say it would be very pleasant to be convinced that one was exceedingly bright and worthy of all the attention one got.
But you suggest in your autobiographical writings that you've been rather blown about through life, that you're rather like tumbleweed. You've fetched up in these places, although they've been very eminent. They are very eminent places.
Well, that is true. I have sort of drifted about mostly within the university system in this country and in the United States. I've never stayed longer than 8 years in any job, and that's very unusual in an academic profession. And I can't really explain it, a kind of natural a quickness to be bored with whatever one's got. That's usually the explanation. Other explanations, of course, are quarrelling with people.
But what else might you have been, one wonders?
I don't know. I used to think I might have been a musician. There was no evidence that I could ever have been a musician. I was extremely untalented at everything musical that I tried.
You tried the violin, I thought.
Tried the clarinet, and I had no particular gift. In fact, I had the obverse of a gift for the clarinet.
But, I mean, to be clear, we're not just talking about your professional career here. I mean, again, you've talked about when you've written about your life as a sailor in the war and as a husband and as a father. And if I can quote you to yourself, you talk about failures and half-failures as a husband and father, academic mistakes and much time and spirit wasted in epochs of unease.
I think when you write about yourself, you know, if you are a writer, you tend to let the book write you, in a sense. There's an example. That sentence is obviously chiselled out as a very good sentence. That may have more weight than its actual content.
Oh, really? So it was you were writing rather than telling the truth?
Well, right? I think that must be so. I think what's difficult to understand about autobiographies is that what you're writing is about now. You're not writing about the past at all. You're really writing about the moment in which you're writing.
And your perception of the past.
Yes, and it's how you feel at that moment somehow. And if you feel like producing a good sentence, you do.
We shall explore. But tell me about your first piece of music, because, as you've indicated, music is played a not inconsiderable part in your life.
Well, I chose this part of Handel's L'Allegro ed il Penseroso, partly because, strangely enough, I first heard it 60 years ago in the Isle of Man, which you might not, from your opening remarks, have thought to be a place where you would hear unusual music played. But in fact, I did hear it, and I remembered it ever since. It's now become very celebrated because of the Colosseum performances recently. I also chose this bit of it because Michael Ginn, or Ginn, is a boy soprano, and I was a boy soprano. And so altogether it seemed to me a suitable way to start the list.
Thank you. Michael Ginn singing part of Handel's L'Allegro ed il Penseroso with the English Baroque soloists conducted by John Eliot Gardner. So, Frank Kermode, you sang in the choir as a boy. Was there music in the house? Did you have a gramophone or radio?
Yes, we had a gramophone of the kind with a big horn on it. And radio, I think my father built one of the first radios in the Isle of Man, in fact, in the very, very early days. And there again, we had to listen through a horn. You had to put your ear in the horn.
And what did it play to you? Do you remember?
Well, it played. That's where I first heard promenade concerts, for example, which were very important to me in my youth. They weren't interesting to my family, but they were to me.
But you weren't apparently the son that your father wanted you to be, or you felt you weren't.
I think he was baffled by me, really, because I couldn't do anything. Even all the things that he thought boys and men should be able to do, I was quite unable to tackle.
What sport?
Well, I did play, well, not very well. He didn't like me for not being able to play very well, because he could. He just thought I was sort of so hopelessly impractical, which indeed I was and am. It's not going to be very good on the island, though.
And what about books in the family? Were there many books at
home? Very few. My mother was interested in poetry, and particularly in the local poet, T.E. Brown, was the first poet I ever read, had read to me. Nobody bothers about him anymore, either.
And did you then have a feeling, and again, it's something you've written about, did this sense of not belonging then, of being in the wrong place?
Yeah, well, I think I've always had that. Of course, there was a good deal about my life as a child that wasn't miserable. On the other hand, there was a good deal that was. And there was always, I always had a sense, I think, that I would have to leave home. And I always had that sense. That's why I moved about so much, actually.
But England was a foreign country.
England was a foreign country. The only visits we ever paid were day trips to Liverpool.
Tell me about your next record.
The next record, like some of the others that I've chosen, has to stand as a symbol of a great deal of other music. The whole of Schubert's piano music, in fact. But all I could choose was one short piece. And I've always particularly admired the way Clifford Curzon played this impromptu.
Clifford Curzon playing part of Schubert's impromptu in A flat major. By the sound of it, then you emerged, as it were, blinking into the world when you arrived in Liverpool.
Yes.
Humming city, was it?
Yeah, it was. It was a lively place, and the university was a lively place. Quite lively enough for me, I think.
Certainly livelier than anything you'd known.
Yeah.
And the Philharmonic Hall, I think you...
That was important, yes. I sold tickets there. I showed people to their seats or sold programmes there, and therefore got in for nothing.
But what about people? I mean, they must have been so... I mean, everything must have been a revelation to you after this rather cloistered...
It was. Even the trains looked enormous. It was it was a very strange transformation. Of course, it did me good, and I think I flourished as an undergraduate.
Did you then, for one small moment, feel you were in the right place?
Yes, I think I did. I did understand, however, that all these other people were far more sophisticated, smarter than I was.
But at some point during this time, anyway, a few years on into Liverpool, you wrote your first book, didn't you? A study of a man called Aaron Hill. Had you tried by this stage writing a novel or poetry?
Yes, I had. I was busy. I wrote plays and novels. They're all no good. And so, of course, I gave up doing it.
Did people tell you they were no good?
No, I didn't give them a chance.
Did you then decide that you wouldn't be a writer, that you...
Well, I knew I wasn't any more than I was a singer or a violinist or anything else, so I fell back on criticism, I suppose you might say.
But have you perhaps thought since then that that was the wrong decision?
Writing that book you've been quoting from was fun because it was not constricted by the usual conditions of writing academic criticism or reviews, which I do a great deal of. You know, and so it was. That was more fun to write than anything else I've ever written, I suppose.
Your autobiography.
And so perhaps I should have done more of it.
But not just for that reason, but because it's actually the writing itself, apart from the content, has been, you know, much praised by distinguished writers themselves, you know, David Lodge, John Updike. You know, perhaps you were too hard on yourself.
I think I should have let go a little earlier, yes.
Do you? No, but do you really think that?
I do think that, yes.
That you could have done some creative writing?
I think I might, yes. I don't think I'd ever be a good novelist because I'm not very good at noticing things. Or indeed at getting on with people. Knowing people is a difficult thing.
But you don't have to get on with people or know people to write creatively. I mean, you just have to be imaginative.
Well, you have to have a certain amount of know-how about how human beings behave and interact, and I don't think I have much of that.
Record number three
is From the Creation, which I think is a lovely work, and everybody knows a lot of it, I think. But what they don't know, because it's very often omitted, I think, in amateur performances, is a wonderful duet between Adam and Eve towards the end of the oratorio, which is sort of the finest, sort of most radiant celebration of unspoiled married love that you could possibly find in music, I think. Of course, it didn't last very long. It was all over about a day later, wasn't it?
Edita Gruborova as Eve and Robert Hull as Adam, singing part of Haydn's Creation with the Vienna Symphonic, conducted by Niklas Arnoncourt. You've written, Professor Kermode, that in the war you learned to deal with the madness of captains. Can you explain that?
Well, I had a rather strange war. I think I never met anybody else who had a similar experience, but I did find myself acting as secretary to people who were crazy and drunk a lot of the time, and I think I learned a lot from this.
You were the kind of ship scribe, weren't you?
Yes, I was the captain's secretary, and for the longest time, when we were anchored in a fjord in Iceland, I had to deal with this maniac, who turned out to be actually a rather selfish maniac, because he was accumulating stores for sale on the black market when he got home.
But they weren't just mad, these captains. I mean, they did ridiculous things like shooting themselves. I mean, a lot of them died.
Yes, one of them shot himself. Another fell down a flight of stairs. Their antics were unbelievable, but not so surprising to more seasoned seafarers than I. I mean, they rather expected a lot of this from captains.
And you spent, it seems, a good part of the war, 2.5 years, I think, trying to put a boom across an Icelandic...
Yes, for 2 years we tried to lay a boom across a fjord in Iceland. I think it was, in fact, an impossible task.
And you failed.
And we failed, yes. Having wasted vast quantities of material, all sunk at the bottom of the fjord.
It does sound quite incredibly absurd.
Well, it's all part of the element of sheer craziness in war is, well, it's forgotten. I mean, we know it's terrible and that millions of people get killed and so on, but the silliness is quite extraordinary too. But I do think my experience is a bit freakish. I've been talking of late to some American friends who were fighter pilots in the Pacific. And they really, you know, flying from carriers, they had a totally different kind of war. They were really mixed up in world-changing battles and so on, not messing about on the fringes.
But when you signed up, you were full of expectation, weren't you? You thought you were going to change the world.
I'm not so sure about that. You know, the summer of 1940 was such a peculiar time when it is perfectly possible that by autumn we would have been occupied by Germany. So, in fact, nothing seemed very serious at the time. You thought what you might do in the circumstances. And one of the things, I mean, in a way, going to sea seemed rather a good idea.
Record number four.
Record number four is a representative, again, of Mozart's operas, which are truly important to me. And I think Così fan tutte is possibly the most beautiful opera ever written. So it's very difficult to pick a piece of it that will have to stand for all the rest. However, this wonderful little trio from the first act will have to serve.
Part of Soave Sil Vento from Mozart's Così fan tutte, sung by Leila Kubeli, Cecilia Bartoli and John Tomlinson, with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. So to academia, Frank Kermode. You've written about looking up from reading a poem in a lecture theatre and seeing faces gleaming with the experience of poetry. How often did that happen?
Not very often, I don't think. I think that as I... In fact, in my retirement, I've been teaching a good deal and doing it very differently from the way I used to do it, because I think now what one does is get a group of people together around a table and bury them in some poems. And the hell with all this nonsense about the intellectual background and so on. We just read poems together. And this is when, it's taken me a long time to find this out, you'll agree, this is when something actually... There's a transaction of some importance between the teacher and the taught, which you don't get in the rather stiff situation of the university lecture system, which has been so dominant in our academic tradition.
So it's that moment of something understood is...
That's right, that's right. Mm. And also I believe people are interested... and surprised sometimes to find that there is quite a heavy technical aspect to good poetry, which they've tended not to be told about in the past.
But what has happened to the teaching of English in our universities over the past 25 years, as you just indicated, is that something different occurred, that something that some would say legislated against that something understood, because I get into deep water here, but so you'll have to help me, but the new literary theory, which you helped in many ways introduce, did, as I say, well, define it for me, if you will, first of all.
Well, this was really, it was kind of major change came over the theoretical aspects of literary criticism in the 1960s. I won't specify them, it would be very boring to do so, but mostly they originated in Paris. And they seemed to me at that time extremely interesting. But, of course, what's happened to them is what happened in the past to other nostrums for literature and the philological one. Well, what's happened is that it has taken attention away from the texts themselves, so that people are now much more interested in refining theoretical positions which are totally out of touch with literary texts.
So the study of the linguistics or the social conditions in which the piece was written becomes so analysed and so studied that the value is in that analysis itself and ceases to be in the literature, as it were.
Well, that's right, that's right. I mean, even that degree of contact with the text is sometimes given up altogether. You know, I've had very good students who've said they're really only taking courses in literature in order to get out of it and study what they now call theory. Theory in with a capital T, which is not literary theory anymore. I mean, it's theory of everything. Mm. And fine, as long as we can still have some people who are susceptible to the effect of good literature, particularly poetry.
You must, or perhaps you don't, do you feel a little guilty that you helped bring all of this in, as it were, because you had a ringside seat. You were very active.
I did, I suppose. Well, that was when I was in London. No, since then I've really become... in politics, I've never taken the track from left to right, which is supposed to happen, but I have in this respect, and I now spend a good deal of time giving lectures denouncing this, this business.
Next record.
I didn't know what to choose from Figaro. The obvious choice would be Susanna's wonderful aria in the last act, but this little letter song, sung by the Countess and Susanna, in Act 3, will remind me of all the rest.
Carlotta Margiono and Barbara Bonney singing part of the duet from Act 3 of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. There have been various moments in your career, Frank Kermode, when you've found yourself hitting the headlines, and on each occasion I suspect you'd rather not have done. The most recent was last autumn when you moved house in Cambridge and boxes of your books were taken away and pulped by refuse collectors. What exactly, first of all, did you lose?
Well, I lost a lot of irreplaceable things, some manuscripts, not my own manuscripts. For example, I lost a manuscript which had been given me some years ago by Stephen Spender, which is a valuable manuscript. That was destroyed. But a great many books, about 2,000 books, in fact, were destroyed. And this takes the heart out of a library. Unfortunately, the boxes that were destroyed all came from the room where I kept my best books. And anyway, it's a sad tale.
But how did it happen?
It's a typical piece of these idiocies invade my life. It happened by a confusion between removal men and garbage collectors. I still go to my shelves for a book and then discover that it isn't there.
It's one of those.
And, of course, I've now learned that the area which is most devastated, you know, I know not to look. But I'm trying slowly to replace these.
Another headline-hitting moment was back in the 60s when you co-edited the magazine Encounter and were misled about the magazine's CIA connections. You were duped, really, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
The top and the bottom of it. Yeah. You've admitted as much. You seem to be quite dupable, if I... If there is such a word, and if I can make that observation, do you feel you are?
Well, I don't know. I think in a rather long life by now, one learns to suss out some of the more obvious attempts to swindle. But I think circumstances have been such And perhaps my basic naivete is such that you're right in what you say. I won't deny it.
That you usually tend to believe people when they say something, if they're kind of, if they appear to be decent and amiable, you believe what they say.
Yes, I want to please them, and I please them by pretending that I believe them, or actually believing them.
Record number six.
Well, record number six is the Actus Tragicus. It's a wonderful cantata about death. I've sung in it and loved it for a great many years. But it has, of course, many times been recorded, but the recording that we're going to use here seems to be the most beautiful of them, partly because of the exquisite singing of Teresa Stitch Randall.
Part of the Actus Tragicus from Bach's cantata BWV 106, sung by Teresa Stitch Randall with the Vienna State Opera Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Felix Proaska. And so to Cambridge you went in 1973, which was to be your last full-time post. You became King Edward VII Professor of English Literature. But you didn't have a secretary and you didn't have an office and you were forbidden to give tutorials. I mean, did nobody tell you this was how it was going to be?
People did, in fact. I remember Lord Annan telling me that I should rapidly rethink the position before I took it up. But I did go, and I should have found out more about it. I don't think people were possibly unkind. Cambridge is where I live, and which I like very much, can also be a very chilly place, socially. Perhaps modelled it too, I'm not sure about that.
But worse than that, wasn't it? I mean, again, let me quote yourself to yourself, a cauldron of unholy hates hissed about me.
Well, that's meant to be a joke based on St. Augustine's remark that when you got to Carthage, a cauldron of unholy loves raids all about him. That was a very odd time, that first year at Cambridge, because they'd set up everything for the following year. I had no place in any of the plans. And, of course, I'd been used to something quite different, having been head of department for something like 15 years before I went there. I thought I would actually have something to say in the way things were done, but I had none at all. And so I was a little bit... To find that one hasn't an office, even, that was very surprising, let alone a secretary. All the time I was at Cambridge, I wrote all my own letters, either typed them or wrote them by hand.
It all finally came to a head nearly a decade later, really, didn't it, when you championed a young don called Colin McCabe, said then to be a structuralist, someone who believed in this new theory, whom the faculty wouldn't give a job. And the result was, in the end, you resigned. But effectively, you were finally forced out, weren't you?
Well, I simply got so fed up with it all. I was also not very well. I had very bad eye troubles at the time, and there were all sorts of reasons why it seemed a very cosy thing just to pack it in, so I did.
But it was all, wasn't it, campus politics at their most ruthless?
Well, they were, in fact, yes, that is quite true. And you have to give your heart and mind to that kind of thing to succeed, I think. I'm never willing to do that.
Record number seven.
Record number seven is the... Really, I suppose I chose it again as a representative, but also because it is the last part of Beethoven's last sonata. The sort of general idea of lastness creeping in here.
Alfred Brendel playing part of the Arietta from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32. So you still live in Cambridge, although you haven't taught in the faculty since you resigned.
No, I haven't. No.
You live alone now, and again, you've written like Tristram Shandy, you sleep diagonally in your bed.
Yes.
Do you enjoy your solitary state? I
mean, for the most part, yes. It's softened by friends, and people come to stay sometimes. No, I'd rather be like Adam and Eve in the creation, but I'm not. Adam before his rib was removed.
But do you feel now at last that maybe you're at the right table as opposed to the wrong one? That is to say, your own table by yourself, is that?
Yes, it's a wonderfully free life. All I have to occupy me is work, really. And so then it's as if work had taken the place of pleasure, you know, and company. So I do work hard, not because I feel any need to, but because there's nothing else to do, really.
But what conclusion then do you come to about yourself, if we're following this theme about your having been always in slightly the wrong place? I mean, perhaps, you know, that was your role. Perhaps you are an outsider. Is that what you're meant to be?
Well, in a sense, I am, yes, I think. Although it seems silly to say so when I've had so many allegiances and associations. But on the whole, I think I'm really better off now than I've ever been before.
Tell me about your last record.
The last record is as far as I venture into the 20th century. I'd have chosen many more, but this is a lovely moment, I think, from Der Rosenkavalier, the presentation of the Silver Rose. And just for old time's sake, I've asked you to do the recording by Elizabeth Schumann, made in 1933, which was the first one I ever heard.
Elizabeth Schumann as Sophia and Maria Olszewska as Octavian, singing the duet, The Presentation of the Rose, from the second act of Der Rosenkavalier by Richard Strauss, with the Vienna Philharmonic conducted by Robert Hager. And that was recorded in September 1943. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records.
Oh, it would have to be the Bach, I think, the Actus Tragicus.
And what about a book as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
Well, book, I thought about this. I thought it had to be a very long book, probably a book that I ought to have read by now and haven't, like Gibbon's Decline and Fall. So I voted for Gibbon.
And your luxury?
Well, there again, I gave this a lot of thought, and I imagine what I would like is something very beautiful that represents a climate and an environment quite unlike the one that I'm in on the desert island. So I decided to ask you to persuade the trustees of the Tate Gallery to part with a painting by Samuel Palmer called Moonlit Landscape with Sheep. I'll settle for that.
I'm sure they'll deliver it. Direct. Sir Frank Kermode, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.